a growing... The word is magic, literally. Magic evokes both our childlike desire for wonder and our cynical determination not to be fooled again. Alex Stone is both a magician and a physicist, and his book, Fooling Houdini, is part history, part memoir, part instruction manual. How do magicians manage to trick us, and why do we keep coming back for more? His book is published by HarperCollins. I'm very pleased it has brought Alex Stone to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why do you think we're so attracted to being tricked?
I think it's something organic in our minds and in our emotional makeup. We like to revisit that time when we were a kid and everything was mysterious and new. I think that, you know, psychologists have studied this. There's some kind of, you know, being fooled is like a controlled way of experiencing a loss of control, like being on a roller coaster or seeing a scary movie.
Because we know we're being fooled. Well, so are we, do we want to be fooled? Do we help the magician?
I think that's right. I mean, it's similar to the willing suspension of disbelief that you bring, say, to fiction. It's a willful kind of self-deception. But the other thing about it is, in a sense, we can't help but be fooled because magic tricks exploit these cognitive mechanisms that are etched into our brains early on.
Well, are there people who can't be fooled by magic tricks who really just know where to look at all times?
I'll tell you, the hardest people sometimes to fool, and I'm not the only one who'll say this. If you ask expert magicians, they'll concur, is our children. Sometimes I fooled Nobel Prize winners with what I consider to be fairly simple tricks, but a 9-year-old will often rip apart my A material. And I think it has to do... Well, there might be a prosaic reason, which is that kids are shorter, so they see certain angles, and they're not, you know, polite in many cases.
But there's also misdirection involved in magic, isn't there? And maybe kids aren't always looking where
that's exactly
you expect
right.
them to look or want them to look.
And it's not so much – it's not even looking, because we can be looking right at something, but if we're not attending to it, we might not see it. And the brilliant psychologist Alison Gopnik has a line where she says, you know, when we say that adults are good at paying attention, what we really mean is – as adults, we're good at not paying attention, ignoring peripheral distractions. Kids kind of pay attention to lots of things at once.
Well, you've called your book Fooling Houdini. Is the goal of magicians to fool each other?
Magicians love to fool each other, and they invest a lot of time and energy in engineering new tricks designed to dupe one another. And there's even a Magic Olympics every 3 years. It is this big tournament. It's the World Championships. Magicians from all over the world descend on a city, and they battle it out to see who's the best and who can fool the, you know, fool other magicians the most.
The child of one of our producers saw a magician steal a watch from his dad's wrist at a bar mitzvah, and his question was, why be a magician? Why not just steal watches?
That's right. Practice on the subway.
Is there an overlap between the two?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the techniques that are used in magic were, you know, come from the street, from pickpockets, from con artists. There's a, you know, both employ the techniques of deception. Some people employ these techniques to entertain people, to amaze them, to mystify them, but other people employ them to steal money, to steal people.
Or to win at poker.
Or to win at poker, or to beat the house, or to instill false belief systems. But the watch stealing is also interesting because it's the kind of thing, you know, that you would really expect to notice. But the fact is that the vast majority of people don't, because when we're not expecting something or when we're distracted, our minds are literally blind to these very obvious things.
Yeah, but it seems almost impossible to take a watch off of someone's wrist without them noticing, because I feel the watch going on, I feel the watch going off.
But that's because you're really paying attention to it. You're attending to it. But when you think about it, most of the day you're not thinking about your watch and you're not expecting it. And, you know, I even did an experiment with a psychologist at the New School. We brought people in and stole their watches while I distracted them with the coin trick. And, you know, 4 out of 5 people didn't notice. And I'm not even that great at it. I mean, expert magicians probably get caught 1 in 100 times. And the fact is that we don't notice the things that we don't notice. So we tend to overestimate our own powers of perception. But in fact, there are these big gaps in our awareness that influence our daily lives, you know, why we shouldn't talk on the cell phone while driving, or how we're inundated with information, and there's a bottleneck. There's only so much that we can perceive, and magic is about exploiting these gaps.
Well, you gave instruction for stealing watches to the Wall Street Journal, and people were concerned because those guys are already stealing so much from us.
That's right. My favorite part about that article was the comment section, because it very quickly this couldn't have been, there's nothing political about this piece. It's just about magic and perception. And yet within like three comments, it was all about how, oh, this is what Obama is doing to our country. And it evolved into a political screed. And I thought that was pretty hilarious.
He never took my watch.
Yeah. And one guy.
Interviewed him once. He didn't take my watch.
Yeah, I know. He's probably got a pretty nice
watch. But Three Card Monty, in a way, is a version of magic.
It is a magic trick. It's a form of theater, really. It involves a cast of shills, each playing their role, a carefully choreographed form of theatrical art, in a way. And this is sleight of hand. Magicians often do the Three Card Monty at their shows. The great thing about the Three Card Monty is it still works. And I've seen people lose hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And I mean, I think the biggest misconception is that it works because people don't realize it's a scam. But I think pretty much everyone does. The way it works is it convinces you that you can write yourself into the scam. And the Three Card Monty, back in the 1900s, or the late part of the 20th century, I mean, sorry, the 19th century, it was the foundation of the great modern criminal empires. I mean, people on the riverboats, one group in one year made what today would be $25 million. And it's really the scams like the Three Card Monty and the shell game really built the first organized crime networks and syndicates that really are the ancestors of the modern mob.
But it looks too easy to be true. Why doesn't that make people suspicious?
They are suspicious, I think, but the con artist, and whether it's the Three Card Monty or the Nigerian bank scam or, you know, Bernie Madoff's billion-dollar Ponzi scheme, I think that these types of scams have a way of safe-cracking this greed, this kernel of greed that everyone has, and convincing us, you know, it's a confidence scheme. It builds confidence. And they're very deft at convincing you that, whoa, you can exploit the exploiter. You can scam the scammer. I think an old grifter once said, cons and gyps are nothing but but the biter being bitten.
Alex Stone's book, Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind, is published by Harper. You have a degree in physics, master's degree?
That's correct.
Is there any link between that and your interest in magic?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. There's kind of a metaphorical link, which is that when you study physics, modern physics, that's, for example, the quantum level, or when you study relativity, you see that all these things that we would call magic actually happen. Particles popping in and out of the vacuum, tunneling through solid objects, time slowing down, space contracting and warping. And this stuff is as magical as it gets. But then there's also a more direct connection, which is that a lot of mathematicians and scientists are interested in magic. And mathematicians have invented a lot of tricks that are based on mathematical principles, and they've even derived mathematical results by, say, studying the way cards are shuffled. So tricks have inspired new math, and math has inspired new tricks.
But it's more likely to be mathematicians, nerds, geeks. I can't imagine the star quarterback pulling a coin from behind a girl's ear.
Well, that's probably true.
Johnny Carson talked about how he was a lonely kid and he took up magic to connect to people.
I think that's right. I think magic is good for, you know, it's a way of kind of putting yourself in the spotlight and seeming extroverted while at the same time maintaining a social distance, you know? And it's good for, you know, it's a good way to sort of contend with self-esteem issues and you know, build confidence, or at least fake confidence, while you're growing up.
So on a first date, would you want to steal your date's watch?
It might cause trust issues that would have to be resolved later on, but it would certainly get their attention.
The book begins with you performing at the World Championships of Magic that you were talking about earlier. You had a sponsoring organization?
So the Magic Olympics, right, which is put on every 3 years, is governed by this body, this UN-like consortium called the FISM, which is based out of France. And in order to become a competitor, you have to get permission, written permission from the president of one of the member societies. So you have to have the imprimatur of the president. So I was approved by the president of the Society of American Magicians, which was actually founded right here in New York in 1902. And I went sort of under their banner.
And how well did you do?
I got creamed. I got disqualified in the middle of my act, basically because I was so bad and so unprepared. I mean, basically, these were the best magicians from all around the world, and I was so outclassed. It was basically like someone, you know, who jogs a few times on the treadmill, you know, every a week at the gym, decides to go compete against Bolt at the Olympics.
And why did you do that?
Partly delusion, partly I wanted to test my mettle and see how I could do. I didn't realize just how talented and how much discipline these people had and how high the skill level was. And I guess just blind hubris.
Can you go to a school to learn this, like the
yes.
Hogwarts, or
actually,
do you have to learn from another magician?
Well, a lot of it is an oral. I mean, magic is still in many ways an oral tradition, and you learn from the old masters that hang out at the, you know, at the backs of diners. But there are magic academies. For example, in the United States, there's this in Vegas. There's this school called the Magic and
Mystery
School.
I'm not surprised.
School.
Las Vegas is where.
Yeah,
it is.
Exactly. And it's this, you know, academy. I took a 3-day master class there. They have residency programs where you can stay there. Everyone is required to take an oath of secrecy while you go. But and in other countries, like in Korea and China, for example, there are state-sponsored magic schools where, you know, students train under informal apprenticeships. They have masters, and you know, and then there are schools. There's the Madrid School in Spain is a big one.
But just sworn to secrecy, there are people who have revealed magic tricks. Penn and Teller did a TV show exposing tricks.
Yeah, I love
Penn and Teller. Were magicians upset?
They were furious. I mean, Penn and Teller, I actually spoke to Teller about this once, and he said, you know, magicians were absolutely furious when they first started. But now, you know, I think people have realized that Penn and Teller are really elevating the art because they play to the audience's attention. They play to the audience's intelligence. They don't condescend to the audience, and they still fool them. So Penn and Teller will, for instance, reveal a trick and then do the same trick another way, and it still fools people. And they'll even do a trick while explaining it. And I think that really is brilliant because it shows you that, well, for one, it doesn't sort of make children out of the audience. It treats them like intelligent adults. But it also shows you that a lot of magic can still fool you even when you know how it's done because it exploits these innate organic principles.
I still don't understand how he stays in that tub of water for so long. You also got into some trouble for an article you wrote in Harper's.
Oh, brother, yeah.
These are not copywritten, these tricks.
No, it's actually interesting. Magic kind of occupies a bit of a shadow space in the realm of intellectual property. You can't really copyright a trick, kind of the same way you can't really copyright recipes or fashion. But you can patent it, but if you patent it, it automatically becomes part of the public record. So it's kind of counterproductive. And as a result, you know, people don't really have a way of safeguarding their own tricks. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, a lot of tricks attribution becomes very important. So a lot of tricks are named after the magicians who invented them.
Now, do magicians get upset by some people like John Edward, who offers to speak to some of the World Trade Center dead on behalf of their families?
Yeah.
Or when Uri Geller used to bend forks and claim that it was really mind over matter rather than just a magic trick?
There are magicians who actually spend a lot of time debunking these types of people. I mean, Houdini actually spent a great deal of his life and energy debunking spiritualists because he saw that they were deceiving people. And, you know, James Randi, for example, he's done a lot to expose these
people. He's offered
he's offered that $1 million prize to anyone who could demonstrate psychic powers in a controlled study. So there are that. In fact, it's really curious at the International Magic Convention in London not long ago, they gave Uri Geller an award for his service to magic. And it was kind of this strange thing because, you know, he doesn't brand himself as a magician. He says, "Oh, I'm not a magician." But that yet all these magicians who know how he does all his tricks were like, congratulations, you know, you're a great magician. And so it was kind of a weird sort of slightly backhanded award.
So where do you go from here? Back to magic, or are you going to go back to physics?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, probably I'll keep writing because that's sort of my main thing is to write and tell stories. But I will always be doing magic. I love magic. It's super fun. There's always so many new things to learn. There's so much innovation and creativity. Physics is something I also love and will always continue to study. Whether or not I'll actually be a research scientist, I don't know.
Well, physics is a lot cheaper to do than magic. It costs you a lot of money. Does the IRS accept all the expenses that you list?
I like to say in my book that, you know, one of my worst fears is I'll be audited, not because I don't keep all my taxes in order, because I'd have to admit to someone just how much money I've spent on magic over the years. It's kind of an embarrassing number.
Well, you will be doing a reading.
Yes, actually,
signing books tomorrow at 7 at Barnes & Noble on 86th Street between Lexington and 3rd. Will you be doing any magic tricks?
There will be some magic, yes, absolutely.
Alex Stone's Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind is published by Harper. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.